Chapter 7, please. Daniel 7. It's good to be back with you this week. Grayson, Natalie, Hannah, and I had a just wonderful week together. So many good things I could tell you about. I'll tell you about a couple of them at the end, but just a wonderful week. Good to be back with you. Grayson, of course, great to have you with us. So much we could say, but good to be with everyone before our God this morning. So what in the world is this evil image I have up here? It's a bit non-traditional for one of my normal sermon backgrounds. This morning, what I would like to do is talk about beasts. And we're not going to talk about any beasts, but we're going to talk about some scary, weird beasts. There's two motivations for the lesson this morning. The first is I just finished teaching the book of Daniel for a full week, and it has just been immensely on my mind. I've thought of nothing else really for the last week. So we're going to look at a message from Daniel 7. The second reason is I would like to start a series that I'm going to look at over the next few months this morning about Christian behavior and Christian ethics. It was this time last year I did a series on the voice of God, talking about how God establishes authorship and authority. And this year what I would like to do is look at Christian ethics. Why should we behave the way that we do? I'm not going to preach a straight series of 13 lessons like I did last year. Wisdom, learn from the good parts. It was good to have that many lessons. I'm going to break this one up some. So like the next 2 weeks we're going to talk about this, then we'll take a week off and go back to it every once in a while. But I really want to ask the question, why does Christian behavior matter? And you'll see how this evil beast is going to provide a good introduction for that this morning. The question I'd like to pose more specifically this morning is, what does Daniel 7 teach us about our role in this life? Typically, Daniel 7 is taught as a passage about the kingdoms of history and present kingdoms, and it certainly is that. If you were in the Daniel class in the upper classroom last 2 quarters ago, we talked about this, how Daniel 7 talks about the rise and falls of kingdoms. But Daniel 7 is also a deep text about Christian behavior. And I'd like to demonstrate this morning what Daniel 7 teaches us about practical living. Before we do that, I would like to read to you from Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. I would ask you not to turn there, but just listen to the text. Just listen to the text of Genesis 1, 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heaven, the livestock, and over the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." God here is saying, let us make man, quote, in our image. The key principle from Genesis 1 is this. When God made mankind, man and woman, it was something very special. God had made light, He had made the planets, He had made the dust, He had made the waters, He had made the birds, He had made the fish, He had made everything that can be seen and everything that can't be seen. But when God goes to make humanity, it's something very special. Because God says, "Let us make man in our image." You'll notice the key principle here, it's twofold. Man is to, number one, bear the image of God, be image bearers. And the second thing man is to do is have dominion, rule over the beast, the fish, the birds, the livestock, every creeping thing. Be image bearers and have dominion over the beast. That's the principle from Genesis 1. God created man and said, "Bear my image and rule over the beast." Probably a familiar principle to most of us. But now with that in mind, look with me at Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. As you get to Daniel chapter 7, this is, I really think it's the climax of the book of Daniel, upon which everything else hinges. Because Daniel himself has a vision. Look at Daniel 7, verse 1. Daniel 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his head. And as he lay in his bed, then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, he begins his dream, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another." Let me read this to you one more time. What does this remind you of? I saw in my vision, verse 2, by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Before the light comes, a wind blows over the waters. What does that remind you of? Before the light comes, a wind blows over the waters. This is a retelling of Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, what you have is the Spirit of God, the breath of God, the Ruach of God, blows over the waters, and then from there the light will be given. What you have here in Daniel 7 is a juxtaposition, a contrast to the creation story in Genesis 1. Because in Genesis 1, the Ruach of God goes over the seas, light comes, and goodness comes. In Daniel 7, the wind comes over the water. It's dark. Light doesn't come. But four evil beasts arise. Daniel 7 is a telling of creation. But this is a telling of an evil creation. A wicked creation that arises. Notice with me then these four beasts that arise. Verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then I looked at its wings, and it were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a mind of a man was given to it. So you'll notice in verse 4 what happens. You have a lion with eagle's wings. The wings are removed, and it's made to stand like a man. Verse 5. And understand, y'all, these are meant to be terrifying things of nightmares. When Daniel in chapter 7 has a dream, this is not the nice type dream that you arise from and like, wow, that was great. This is a dream that you arise and you are sick and terrified. You cannot believe this has happened. Wicked, terrifying, horrible beasts arise. Verse 5. Behold, another beast, a second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise, devour much flesh. Here you see a bear with three ribs in its mouth. But it is told, arise, devour much flesh. Get this image with your minds. How does a bear eat? Okay, visual demonstration. Typically, bears eat like this, right? Bears eat all four on the ground. This bear is told, no, arise and eat. Verse 6, after this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Here you have a leopard that rules. And then verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were the eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. Here you see a beast, a terrifying, unseemly, wicked, nasty beast that arises, and it is given eyes to see and a mouth to speak. Do you notice what's interesting about each of these four beasts? Remember, this is a recreation of the Ruach going over the waters, but here no light comes. Rather than light coming, four evil beasts arise from the sea. And these four evil beasts come, and do dreadful things. Now, notice with me in contrast to Genesis 1 what happens. In Genesis 1, remember the twofold principle I offered? Man is to bear the image of God and to rule over the beast. Twofold principle. Man bears the image of God and rules over the beast. What you have here is very different from that, because these beasts are terrifying. Is there anything good about this creature? I mean, this is the thing of nightmares. This is the thing of nightmares that arises in your mind and can be the worst of things imaginable, doing terrible things. What then do these beasts do? Here's, I think, the point of each of these. Each of these creatures has the nature of a beast, but imitates a human. Do you see that? Each of these beasts in their nature are beasts, but they imitate men. You have, for example, in verse 4, the lion with eagle's wings that arises but is given the mind of a man. At its nature, it's a lion, but it's given rule and mind like a man. In verse 5, you have a bear that in its nature is a bear, but it imitates man in the way he eats. In verse 6, you have a leopard that in its nature is a beast, but arises and rules. And then verses 7 and 8, you have that dreadful creature that in its nature is a beast, but arises and speaks and sees. Each of these creatures has the nature of a beast, but imitates man. This is a reversal of Genesis 1:26. Because in Genesis 1:26, man was the one that was to have the nature of God and to rule over the beast. But these are creatures with the nature of a beast and are now ruling over man. Genesis 1 has been totally flopped on its head. Well, let's continue the story. What happens? The beasts are going to be judged. Look at verse 9 with me. Daniel 7, verse 9. As I looked, thrones were placed. The Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow. The hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A steam of fire issued and came from before him. 1,000,000 served him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of great words that the horn was speaking. As I looked, the beast was killed, its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Do you notice here what happens? The Ancient of Days, that is God. God comes in fiery judgment, destroys the beast, takes away their dominion, and finally the nature of the beast is revealed. When the lion no longer has the mind of a man, he is seen to be what he is, a beast. When the leopard no longer is able to rule, he is seen for what he really is, a beast. When the horrible beast no longer can speak, its nature is revealed. He's a beast. What happens? When God takes away the imitating power of these creatures, their nature is revealed and they are seen to be beasts. Well, fortunately, that's not the end of the story. Because yes, judgment comes, but something far more epic is about to happen. Daniel 7, verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Do you notice what happens? When the dominion of the beast is revoked, who then is going to rule? The one who will rule is, verse 13, a son of man. A son of man. Now, I think you'll realize that's talking about Jesus Christ. But why here is this title given to Jesus? There is one like a son of man. Many titles could have been given. You go to Daniel 9, Jesus is referred to as the Messiah, the anointed one. Why does it not here read, there came one like an anointed one from the Ancient of Days? I think here's the point. The point is the Son of Man defeats the beast. Finally, Genesis 1 and the order that it was to give is restored. Remember the order of Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, man was to bear the image of God and to rule over the beast. But then in Daniel 7, the beast have dominion over man. Man no longer bears the image of God, but beasts play the role of man. Here's the idea. In Daniel 7, the power of the beast is taken away. And in their place, the one who is ruling is the true image bearer of God. The one who has no form or likeness of a beast rules, but the one who is the true son of Adam, the true son of Eve, the true son of man. What then is the point of Daniel 7? The point of Daniel 7 is God desires his image bearers to rule over creation, rather to give in to the way of beast. Because, brethren, here's the point. When we, created in the goodness of God, give in to pride and anger and greediness and selfishness and sin, our nature is no longer one of man and woman, but our nature is one of a beast. I may be able to arise and eat food like a man. I may be able to talk like a man. I may be able to see like a man. But my nature is one of a beast. And the text tells us that there's coming a point when God is going to judge all those who have the nature of beast. And he is going to restore his good order of creation. Because no longer are the beasts going to be the one ruling with dominion and power out of greed and selfishness and power and might. But it's going to be the ones who are the sons of men, the ones who bear the image of God, who will then rule as God intended it. Brethren, what must we do? What Daniel 7 teaches us is live not as beasts, but bear the image of God. Look with me at Psalm 8, please. Psalm 8, this one is quoted in the New Testament frequently, is a psalm that tells the natural order that God made. Look at Psalm 8. To the choir master according to the Gittith, the Psalm of David. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babies and infants, you have established strength because of your foes to still the enemy and the avenger. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon, the stars which you have set, what is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man, same word as Daniel 7, that you care for him. You have made man a little lower than the heavenly beings, and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. What is the point of Psalm 8? Bear the image of God and rule over the beast. Exactly as God made it in Genesis 1. Our role in this life is to bear the image of God not being a beast, but ruling over them. Now let's take this to 21st century language. Why is evolution so destructive to Christianity? Well, you can deal with the archaeological and historical arguments about it. Not my expertise. Ben could probably explain that far better than I could. But socially, the reason that Darwinian evolution is so destructive to Christianity is that it claims that man is no different from the beast. Man is just a superior beast. We in our nature are perhaps more advanced than a dog or a cat or an ape or a fish or whatever it may be. But back to a common ancestor, our nature's really not much different. I claim, as one who believes in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who gave a son on the cross for my sins, that I do not have any likeness of a beast. Because when God made me, he said, that is very good. God made the beast, and he made the fish, and he made the birds. But then separate from the nature of these beasts, not more advanced, but separate from these beasts, God made men and the son of men. And the son of man is to bear the image of God, not behaving like a beast, but behaving as one who bears the image of God. Brethren, what I would like to do over the next few months is talk about how this idea of image bearers should shape our view of Christian behavior. From the very beginning, man was to think and to act different from everything else in creation, because humanity alone bears the image of God. No dog, no cat, no fish, no well, no eagle, no rock, no tree bears the image of God. But as Grayson said as he began, "This is my Father's world." A tree and a stone and a fish and a bird, they are going to accomplish God's will as God made them to. We as God's image bearers have a decision to make. Will I bear God's image? Or will that image be broken? How will we behave? As beast or as those who bear the image of God? As we close the lesson, go with me back to Daniel. Daniel chapter 4. In Daniel chapter 4, you read the story of King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar sees a dream where a tree is chopped down. And the basic message is, Nebuchadnezzar, humble yourself. You're the tree. Daniel 4:27. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be... This is Daniel speaking to the king. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be lengthening of your prosperity. What does he say? In other words, do not act like a beast, but act as one who bears the image of God, ruling over your dominion with righteousness and mercy. So what happens to the king? Verse 34. Let me read verse 33 for a context here. Immediately the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from among men and ate grass like an ox. His body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers and his nails were like bird's claws. The irony? Nebuchadnezzar had given in to selfishness and greed and pride and instinct. And because of that, he looked like a man, much like the beast of Daniel 7, imitated men, but at his nature he was a beast. So finally, the irony of the situation, God makes him look like that which he always was, a beast. And when Nebuchadnezzar finally sees himself as he really was, yes, this is the story of Beauty and the Beast. Verse 34, at the end of days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. My reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven, among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" When Nebuchadnezzar finally realizes what he was, he seeks to be an image bearer. Living under God's rule, bearing the image of God, and ruling over the beasts of the field and even over those in his dominion with mercy and righteousness and love. As Christians, we understand we must not act as beasts, but we must act as image bearers. God made us as those who bear the image of God. Who will we be? How will we act? Those are the questions I would like for us to ponder. You can be getting out your songbooks this time. So next week, what I would like to do is I would like to actually go back to Genesis 1 and talk in a bit more detail. What does it mean for man to be made in God's image? I'd like to trace this phrase and really understand a bit more. What does it mean to bear God's image? We've begun to talk about it this morning, understanding that bearing God's image makes us different from the beast. But still, I haven't given clear explanation about what that image is. And that's what I'd like to talk about next week. So for the invitation this morning, I'll tell you, I'm going to be a bit longer than I normally am for invitations, but I would like to share with you one thing that happened to me last week. I know that I'm typically a very joking, ha-ha person. This is something I'll be very honest, it's difficult for me to talk about and share. But I'd like to show you a picture. This was the group of guys I got to spend the week with. If you'll notice, Luke is hidden right there back in the back under Colin's head. But I got to spend the week with these 26 guys in the cabin. Had prayer time every day, devotions every night. Got a chance to connect throughout the day. And I should tell you what happened one evening. On Tuesday of camp, we were playing a game where you blow a Q-tip through a straw. It's one of those funny ha-ha camp games. Not thinking it was my stupidity, I took a deep breath and the Q-tip got lodged in my throat right here. I couldn't breathe for a full minute. It was the scariest moment of my entire life, and I mean that seriously. I was scared to death. When it first happened, Natalie was in the room. When it first happened, most of the campers thought, ha-ha, Ryan's playing a joke, it's funny. Some of the older campers and our society leaders realized pretty immediately, no, he really can't breathe. I was able to get out enough air, breathe. And by the grace of God, in the room with me was an ER nurse. Tell me that's not coincidence. I was able to run to her pretty quickly, and she did the Heimlich on me and was able to dislodge it. I kept trying to just do a gag reflex, but I couldn't even move it. And finally, when she gave me that first thrust, it came, and I was able to feel it come loose in my neck and literally pull it out. And it was the best breath I've ever had in my life. I've gotten choked on like roast and stuff like that before, but never where you can't breathe. It was absolutely, utterly terrifying. I was really, really, really shaken by it because I know how that could have happened and could have ended. That night, I'd had probably 100 kids come up to me that day and just be as kind and gracious as any people I've ever met. Nine-year-olds that had just grace to them. I would ask, I really still don't like talking about what happened. But if you want to ask me about some of the things that kids said and did to me, I have dozens of stories I'd love to share. That night, Gary Fisher, who is hidden there in the back, asked me to share what had happened with the dorm. And I spent about 20 minutes explaining what had happened. I talked about some personal things in my life, about loss in my family. I talked about life and the reason we're here. And what the brevity of life reminds you of. Because it's very real. I don't know if you've ever not been able to breathe, but having just finished a year-long study on the Spirit, I think you all know how important the breath of life is. Immediately after we were done, Gary asked Truman, he's the guy in the Under Armour sweatshirt, just a remarkable young man, He asked Truman to say a prayer. Truman said just the most mature and loving prayer that I have ever heard. Before he said amen, the kid in the very middle, who is typically very reserved, leapt out of his bed, gave me a huge hug, pulled me up from the ground. And as I looked around, I saw young man after young man after young man with tears in their face, crying out of empathy for me. 26 guys lined up to give me a hug. It was the smelliest but best hug of my life. But they put me in the middle, gave me a group hug. And I have never experienced so much love in my life. Y'all, this last week I saw God's grace in action. Luke showed me God's grace that night. But I urge y'all to remember, I was brought, and as I said, y'all, I know probably in 5 to 10 years I'll be able to joke about this. It's still, I just can't. The thought of getting a Q-tip stuck in your throat. I had been worried for weeks about Jessica and Brooklyn going up to Chicago, knowing that they would have a wreck while I was up there, knowing something would happen and I wouldn't be able to get to them. I had just been convinced something would happen. They were fine the whole week. They had a wonderful week. But I nearly suffocated over a Q-tip. Brethren, know why you are here. That night, I literally was shaking the rest of the day. And as I told the guys what had happened, we had some serious conversations about what is life about? What are some changes you need to make? Why are you here? And I ask you those same questions. If you have been spurning the Lord's invitation, why? Much like these young men, God is ready to give you His grace. Because every time I've seen someone immersed in the Lord's body, I have seen a flock of God's people ready to embrace and love and to show God's grace. By God's providence, I was in the room with an ER nurse. And I'm fine. My throat hurts a little bit, but it's fine. It's within a week or so, it'll heal itself up completely. But never in a million years did I think that I would be coming back and telling you all this story. Are you ready to obey the Lord's invitation? Kirby, do you have the loft song for us? Who does? Matt does. So brethren, as we stand and we sing, I ask you, is it time to obey the Lord's invitation? If you need to come forward this morning, do so as we stand and sing.